The coronavirus pandemic has turned life as we know it upside down.
We're in the United States of America, and you think to yourself, how in the hell did we let this happen?
How are our communities, our jobs, and our daily lives changing? And where do we go from here?
We've spent billions of dollars hunting down terrorist cells. We don't do that with pandemics. That's the wrong approach.
America Interrupted, a new original podcast series from the PBS NewsHour, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Good evening, I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight.
Stop the pain. Stop us from being tired.
The brother of George Floyd tells Congress there needs to be an end to police violence and racism. Then long lines and broken machines, a messy election in Georgia. We break down what it means for the main event in November. Plus, reopening risks. Alabama sees a surge in COVID cases and a healthcare system struggling to keep pace.
Is impacting disproportionately black people in this city in a region that has a high number of people with underlying health issues.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The national outcry to end racial injustice has expanded tonight, from protests in the streets to appeals to Congress. The setting was a U.S. House hearing, headlined by the younger brother of George Floyd, who died in police custody last month. Congressional correspondent Lisa Desjardins begins our coverage.
One day after burying his brother George, Philonis Floyd walked into the U.S. Capitol with a message, pleading for justice and action.
I'm tired. I'm tired of pain. Pain you feel when you watch something like that. When you watch your big brother, who you looked up to for your whole life, die begging for his mom. I'm here to ask you to make it stop.
He appeared before the House Judiciary Committee, now working on a bill aimed at police brutality and racial profiling. George Floyd's death sparked nationwide protests and conversations around policing and race. Philonis Floyd was one of 12 panelists at the hearing. Another, Angela Underwood Jacobs, is also grieving. Her brother, Patrick Underwood, was shot and killed in Oakland during protests last month while he was working as a federal officer and guarding a federal building. She, too, called out racism by some and also pointed to blind violence that must stop.
I'm wondering, where is the outrage for a fallen officer that also happens to be African American?
Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo echoed the thought that most police officers are good, but said there is urgent need for reform.
There is no denying that changes in policing must be made. We must acknowledge that law enforcement's past contains institutional racism, injustices, and brutality.
But some Republican witnesses, like Daryl Scott, regularly seen at events with President Trump, were cautious.
I agree with the fact that police reform, or better yet, police revision should be enacted. But it has to be one that is sensitive to the stress, tension, pressure, and paranoia that policing produces.
The committee will be in order. We will now proceed under the five-minute rule with questions.
The question round, often the most heated, was largely sober and serious. Asked why his brother died, Floyd said Officer Derek Chauvin, who pressed down on George Floyd's neck, knew him.
Yeah, I think it was personal because they worked at the same place. So for him to do something like that, it had to be premeditated.
Authorities have not yet indicated that Chauvin had a personal motive. Also at the hearing, Republicans pushed back at the idea of defunding the police.
If you believe that we should defund the police, will you please raise your hand? I didn't see anyone raise their hand to defund the police. I certainly didn't see any of the Republican witnesses.
Some panelists objected to how the question was asked and said the idea of moving funding into mental health care and community programs is good. The setting itself was extraordinary, in an auditorium in the Capitol Visitor Center to allow for social distancing. This days after congressional Democrats introduced their police reform legislation. Senate Republicans are trying to outline their own plan this week, with South Carolina Senator Tim Scott leading the effort. The pressure on them is not just national. Today, it was personal, from heartbroken families. Floyd pointed to how his brother died.
You don't do that to a human being. You don't even do that to an animal. His life mattered. All our lives matter. Black lives matter.
I truly hope that you take your positions, your offices so seriously that you want to go back and really work together and collaborate. Because if you can't get it right, there's no hope for the rest of us.
And Lisa joins me now. Lisa, what a hearing. So you reported there about how the Democrats having made public their legislation, the proposed legislation on police reform. Tell us a little bit more about what the Republicans are looking at.
Well, right now, the Republicans don't have a firm outline that they've made public, but we know behind closed doors they are talking about some ideas. They seem to be hovering over a few common themes, at least the Senate Republicans. Let's look at those in a graphic here, Judy. First of all, one of those blocking chokeholds. We know that's something Democrats want to do as well. Also, Republicans are looking at some kind of registry of deaths and mistreatment of police. That's a tricky topic for them because they feel that some of them feel states should be governing that, but that is on the table for them. Also, anti-lynching legislation. That is legislation that actually has been blocked by a Republican up till now, Rand Paul, but he seems to be perhaps working with this group to find a way that he can get on board. Also, the idea of a national commission on criminal justice. Judy, that idea from Republicans would be similar to the 9/11 commission in scope. It could take several months, but come up with recommendations. But, you know, Judy, I want to talk about what so far doesn't seem to be in their legislation, but is a heated debate among Republicans. A couple of ideas, particularly about what's called police qualified immunity, which is basically courtroom decisions that have held that police have a kind of immunity from being prosecuted in many cases. Now, Republicans are talking about whether to include this in their bill or not. They're divided right now. It's not in their bill. And then one other thing, the concept of no-knock warrants for drug cases. That is something that could end up in this Republican proposal as well.
So, Lisa, you've mentioned a few names of Republicans involved. Who else? What other Republicans is it known or working on this? And how much urgency do they feel? How quickly do you think we could see something?
You know, I think it's really important to talk about exactly who is in the room making the decisions on this. And as we reported, it's led by Tim Scott. And if you look at the others who are on this so-called task force, here are those names. It is Tim Scott's fellow South Carolinian, Lindsey Graham. He is there, I think, because he is the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. Also, John Cornyn of Texas, Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, Ben Sasse of Nebraska, and James Lankford of Oklahoma. These are all people that are thought to have had spent time on these issues before, including past recent criminal justice reform. Judy, I got to say, the urgency and the timing is a bit of a head scratcher. The House of Representatives, the Democrats, are taking their bill to committee next week. They hope to have a floor vote the following week. So the House is on a two-week trajectory to pass major criminal justice reform. The Senate, it is not clear what their time frame is yet. They hope to, again, have an outline, maybe even legislative language this week. But often things can take longer in the Senate than in the House. So we're going to have to see.
For sure. And Lisa, this has been such a wrenching couple of weeks across the country for the American people. We know protests in, 700 American cities. I want to ask you, what's the feeling there on the Hill? Is that coming across when you talk to members? What's the sense of urgency or not there?
I think it's really changed across this week, Judy. Talking to senators on Monday, I didn't feel that the majority of them, Republicans, mostly who I spoke with, had a sense of urgency. Some did, like Lisa Murkowski, seemed to be really taking this in and spending a great deal of time trying to figure out where to go. Others didn't have that urgency. I think they do now. I think that's changing. Now, does that mean they can come up with a deal? I don't know.
And finally, Lisa, a bit of news coming from the Capitol late today having to do with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Confederate statues.
Right. This is a fascinating story. Judy, the Speaker of the House has written a letter to the group overseeing statues in the Capitol asking that 11 statues of Confederates, these are men who served in the Confederacy, be removed from the Capitol. These particular statues have been selected by states. They're part of the National Statuary Hall collection. Each state selects two people. Most of these statues, Judy, were selected in the beginning of the 20th century. They've been there a long time, but these, again, are Confederates. They include the President of the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis, the Vice President of the Confederacy, Robert E. Lee. These are men whose statues are in the U.S. Capitol, have been for a long time. The House Speaker says it's time to remove these statues. And that's kind of a line that no one has crossed before. Until now, they've only put these statues in sort of less prominent locations. One other thing, Judy, this does not, however, include some who were pro-slavery before the Confederacy, like John C. Calhoun, who is depicted in the Capitol four times, including twice outside the Senate chamber. That discussion, I think, will continue.
A lot of people don't realize that.
Yeah.
Lisa Desjardins reporting on what's happened at the Capitol. Lisa, thank you.
You're welcome.
In the day's other news, the police chief in Minneapolis, where George Floyd died in custody, took what he said is a first step towards sweeping change. He called off negotiations with the police union, pending a complete review of the current union contract. The chief said that he needs the flexibility to get rid of problem police.
There is nothing more debilitating to a chief from an employment matter perspective that when you have grounds to terminate an officer for misconduct and you're dealing with a third-party mechanism that allows for that employee to not only be back on your department, but to be patrolling in your communities.
The white policeman who pinned George Floyd by his neck had 17 complaints against him, but he had been disciplined just once. And in Atlanta, two more officers were fired after college students were pulled from a car and tased during a protest last month. Two other officers had already been dismissed. There are calls to investigate Attorney General William Barr for his decision to have protesters forcibly cleared from near the White House on June 1st. Some 1,250 former Justice Department employees made the request today to the department's inspector general. Meanwhile, crews removed some temporary fencing and barricades from near the White House. They have been placed there at the height of the protests. Also today, President Trump rejected stripping the names of Confederate generals from military bases in the southern U.S. He said that he would, quote, not even consider it. But NASCAR banned the Confederate flag from all of its stock car racing events and properties. The Federal Reserve says that it will not raise interest rates through 2022 as the economy claws back from the pandemic recession. Today's announcement came as the Fed projected unemployment will stay above 9% through year's end. Chairman Jerome Powell said that it is essential to keep interest rates near zero in an effort to boost growth.
As you know, we lowered our policy rate very quickly, quicker than others, to the effect of lower bound. And we said that we'll keep it there until the economy has weathered the effects of the virus and is on track to achieve our goals.
The central bank projected that the economy will contract by 6.5% this year, but grow by 5% next year. The country continues reopening from the pandemic, but infections are surging again. More than a dozen states are reporting their highest seven-day averages of new cases yet, and hospitalizations in nine of those states have increased since Memorial Day. All told, there have been nearly 2 million coronavirus cases in the U.S., with 112,000 deaths. A retired federal judge today accused the Justice Department of abusing its power in the case of Michael Flynn. John Gleason blasted the government's motion to drop criminal charges against President Trump's former national security advisor. The trial judge had asked Gleason to review the motion. The ousted State Department Inspector General says that his bosses tried to stop his review of a major arms sale to Saudi Arabia. Transcripts of Steve Linnick's interview by House Democrats were released today. In them, Linnick also said that he was reviewing Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's alleged use of staffers for personal errands. Pompeo responded this morning.
Steve Linnick was a bad actor in the Inspector General office here. He didn't take on the mission of the State Department to make us better. That's what Inspector Generals are supposed to do. They work for the agency head. That's me. My mistake was letting Mr. Linnick stay here as long as he did.
Linnick had been the State Department's Inspector General since 2013. Election officials in Georgia are under searing criticism today after voters waited for hours and voting machines failed in Tuesday's primary. Amid the confusion, a Democratic contest for a U.S. Senate seat remains too close to call. We'll get the details right after the news summary. And on Wall Street, fears of a recession overshadowed news that interest rates will stay low. The Dow Jones Industrial Average slid 282 points, back below 27,000. The Nasdaq rose 66 points, but the S&P 500 lost 17. Still to come on the NewsHour, what election mishaps in Georgia mean for the November vote? Reopening risks. Alabama sees a surge in COVID cases. How gardening can offer fresh air and some sanity in turbulent times, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Trouble with absentee ballots, new voting machines, and a global pandemic created a perfect storm for chaos in Georgia's primary election yesterday. Yamiche Alcindor reports on the challenge voters faced.
Judy, it was one of the biggest tests of the voting systems ahead of the November presidential election. And some voters in Georgia waited more than 5 hours to cast their ballots. Georgia's Secretary of State called the problems, quote, unacceptable. But he put the blame on local election officials during an interview with NewsHour this afternoon.
All of a sudden, we opened up these polling locations, and one of the county election directors said, well, this is the first time that my poll workers have actually touched the system today. And so if you don't, you know, provide training, and that's really a leadership, you know, issue. If you don't provide the management and the oversight to train your poll workers, I know that you had, you know, COVID. I get that.
For a closer look at what went wrong in Georgia, I'm joined by Andra Gillespie. She's a political science professor at Emory University. Thanks so much for being here. Obviously, a lot went wrong in Georgia. What happened with the voting machines, and what do you make of the Secretary of State kind of passing off the blame here?
Well, in short, everything that could go wrong did go wrong yesterday. So there are a number of things that could happen. One, there are some systemic problems with voting in Georgia. So counties that have often had bottlenecks like Fulton County continue to have them. There's still reports that there are places with large African-American populations that saw long wait times and perhaps didn't have the staff or the machines to be able to facilitate voting. And then on top of that, we have the problem of COVID-19 creating additional procedures that were going to lengthen the time of voting, that we're going to require people to stand outside for long periods of time. And you have the problem of this being the first statewide election that was using a new voter system. So people were not used to having the system. And thus, there were problems getting it set up and acclimating the poll workers to the system. And that was probably compounded by the COVID crisis on a number of dimensions. It would have been harder to have in-person training. And in addition to that, there were places where you had poll workers who were reluctant to show up on election day because of their own health and safety. And so they canceled at the last minute, again, understaffing many precincts.
It sounds like a perfect storm of things going wrong. But there's also issues with mail-in ballots. More than 1 million were cast. That's a record. What happened there?
Well, in particular, in Fulton County, there were a number of people who requested absentee ballots who didn't receive them in time to use them and to turn them in time for the election. So some of those people ended up having to stand in line as well. But they also had members of their own elections board staff come down with COVID-19. One actually passed away, and so that actually caused the office to close down for a period. And so they were overwhelmed with these absentee ballot requests. And so it doesn't seem like they were actually able to get a handle on things, in time for some people to be able to get their ballots.
Looking ahead to the November election, how does what is happening in Georgia relate to other states, and what lessons should the nation as a whole be taking away?
Well, this was a dress rehearsal for November. We expect that COVID is going to be with us in November and that more and more people are going to want to vote by absentee because it's safer and it's more convenient. And judging by the lines that some people experienced in Georgia yesterday, some people actually think that it's a more efficient way to run. So the state of Georgia and other states that are not used to having most of their electorate vote by mail are going to have to figure out how to refine their processes so that voters get their ballots in time, so that they are returned in time, so that the instructions are clear. So in the state of Georgia specifically, this is a moment of reckoning. This is a moment where the Secretary of State's office and local elected officials need to evaluate what went right and what went wrong with their procedures yesterday, and they need to try to fix as much as possible. And the recriminations back and forth with local and state officials pointing the finger at each other probably isn't helpful. There's plenty of blame to go around. There seems to be a lack of communication on both sides in many instances, and so it may actually be appropriate for an independent third party to come in, interrogate the system, and quickly provide recommendations about what to do to go forward.
Maybe we have about a minute left here. I want to ask you about Black voters and voters of color. You call this a moment of reckoning. What did we learn from what happened in Georgia that particularly impacts Black people and people of color? And how does that relate to the nation as a whole? What systemic issues do those communities usually face?
So there were procedural issues and there were systemic issues. So I don't want to just chalk this up to voter suppression writ large. I don't think that that actually explains what's going on there. I think the charges of voter suppression come out because some of the precincts that have historically had problems with high turnout and a few machines or machines that don't work seem to be the places where there were problems again yesterday. And so we do need to ask ourselves whether there is a particular bias that routinely undercounts and underestimates the number of Black voters that are going to be showing up in some of these minority-serving districts. We need to figure out whether or not we need to reallocate resources and reallocate machines to these precincts so that they don't have these long lines in voting when there are other places that didn't have the same problems with voting.
A moment of reckoning. Thank you so much for joining me, Andra Gillespie of Emory University.
Thank you.
Your PBS NewsHour podcast will be back in a moment. First, a message from our promotional partners at Volt Studios.
Selena Quintanilla Perez, aquí está con su éxito.
At 23 years old, Selena was on the verge of superstardom. But on March 31st, 1995, those dreams would be cut short after a fateful encounter with her close friend and the president of her fan club, Yolanda Saldivar.
Does it make you angry when people talk about, people say that you are obsessed with her?
Selena, A Star Dies in Texas, a new podcast from Vault Studios.
Why do you believe Selena was killed?
Americans are trying to move closer to their pre-pandemic routines, but there are worrying signs that the virus is continuing to spread in some of the states that have eased restrictions. John Yang has a look at one of those states, Alabama.
In the Vintage Cafe in Montgomery, Alabama, the hustle and bustle is back.
We've done everything from change flooring from carpet to hardwoods, change all of our practices, promoting the use of masks.
Cooks have added extra precautions to their normal kitchen routines. Eric Rivera is the executive chef.
We wanted to bring all of our staff back in, give them the proper training, get all the new training and procedures in place before we decided to open back up to the public. We wanted them, again, to feel safe and secure coming into our establishment, and we wanted to feel safe and secure as well.
Business may be on its way back across Alabama, but so are cases of coronavirus on an upward trend after April 30th, the day state officials began easing restrictions. In a state where college football is king, it's news that University of Alabama and Auburn University players tested positive this month when they returned to campus for workouts. And metropolitan areas like Montgomery, the state capital, have been hard hit. Mayor Stephen Reed, a Democrat.
I think anytime you have a 337% increase month over month, that's a problem, and that's what we had from the month of April to the month of May. And we also saw almost 80% of our deaths that we've reported so far occur in the month of May.
Alabama was among the last states to issue a stay-at-home order on April 3rd, and just 4 weeks later, among the first to begin easing restrictions. Beaches reopened.
We've been stuck in the house so long, so it's like, you know, it's like a breather. You know, we needed to get out, so I just thought I'd bring him out here to enjoy the sun and the water.
In person, though socially distanced, high school graduations were allowed.
Keep praying.
Church services resumed.
It's just nice to be able to get together with really family and just spend time together and worshiping God.
Right here in Sweet Home, Alabama.
Governor Kay Ivey, a Republican, announced the plan.
We cannot sustain a delayed way of life as we search for a vaccine. There are many viruses that we live with and have worked necessary precautions into our daily lives. Standing by and letting our businesses collapse while we've got hundreds of thousands of folks that are hurting and suffering is not an option. Having a life means having a livelihood too.
But we can't put the dollars over the data, and I think unfortunately that's what we ended up doing at the state level, and that I believe contributed to some of the increasing numbers that we saw, but also I think it, you know, just gave people a sense that this pandemic was over and that we had won this battle.
At Alabama's hospitals, though, the battle is far from over. Dr. Rachel Lee is an epidemiologist at the University of Alabama, Birmingham.
We are continuing to care for about 50 to 60 patients with COVID every single day. So what that means is that we have one ICU that's completely full of patients that have COVID-19, one acute care unit that's completely full of patients that are being cared for with COVID-19. And every single day we're having 2 to 3 new cases a day being admitted.
Lee says more study is needed to figure out what's behind the current surge, but says a contributing factor is the state of health care in rural Alabama.
If you are in a smaller area, you may have to drive a long distance in order to even get a test, and that test may be delayed because it has to be shipped somewhere else in order to get a result. So you can see how that infection could potentially spread from one person to the next if there's a delay in getting a diagnosis.
And the current state guidelines, she says, are too lax.
I think what's lacking with some of our recommendations is, you know, we are open in terms of the amount of people that can be around one another. And then also, there's no real restrictions in terms of mask wearing inside retail businesses. And I think without those kind of guardrails up, it is potentially the possibility that you can see this disease spread from person to person.
In Alabama, masks are mandatory for workers at places like hair salons. At Envy Hair Designs in Montgomery, it's required for customers too. Tasha Curry is the owner.
You know, everybody has to wear a mask, and then we're making everybody sanitize as soon as they walk in the door. I'm right up on them when I'm cutting their hair and I'm doing their hair, so I just make sure I keep my mask on, you know, make sure they keep their mask on.
On the streets of Montgomery, Mayor Reed wants to require masks in public, but says a majority of the city council opposes it.
We have to do it because of the surge that we've seen in cases in Montgomery, and more importantly, it is impacting disproportionately black people in this city, in a region that has a high number of people with underlying health issues and other illnesses that make them more susceptible to suffering more seriously from COVID-19 virus.
As leaders and healthcare workers confront this current rise in cases, they worry about what could still be ahead.
If we saw another surge, we would really have to work on thinking through alternative methods to protect our healthcare workers. I think that's probably the thing that keeps me up at night the most.
And business owners Tasha Curry and Eric Rivera worry too, for a different reason.
Oh my gosh, I don't even want to think about having to shut down for another 2 or 3 months. We're going to pray and keep our fingers crossed that everything will be okay, and hopefully we'll make it through again.
And that's one of the things you think about every day is, are they going to close us back down if the cases get too high?
As experts say, people in Alabama and across the nation will likely have to face life without a coronavirus vaccine for some time to come. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
Alabama is hardly the only state that has seen a spike in cases recently. More than 20 states also have had a jump in the past couple of weeks, many in the South and the West. Hospitalizations are also up significantly in at least 8 states. Let's look at this and questions about how to get the right balance while dealing with huge economic problems. Dr. Ashish Jha is director of Harvard University's Global Health Institute, and he joins us from Cambridge. Dr. Jha, welcome back to the NewsHour. As you look at this spike in cases in some places around the country, what does this tell you?
Yeah, so thanks for having me back, Judy. I am worried. I look across the country. I see about 20 states, as you said, where cases are rising. And it probably reflects what happened about 3-4 weeks ago as our country started opening up around Memorial Day, some states even before then. What we're seeing now is cases rising. And the biggest question in front of me is what's going to slow that down? Because I think there's no appetite for shutting those states back down again. The other tool that helps, testing, tracing, and isolation, we don't have that built up the way we need it. And so I'm really worried about what the next few weeks and months are going to look like.
So I heard you say it probably is connected to reopening. Is it definitely connected? I mean, is there proof of a connection?
Well, you know, proof is hard, and we've seen so much variation across states. I mean, some states, for instance, Georgia, I was very worried when it opened up and thought it was opening up too early. We have not seen a spike there. So part of it is local circumstance. Part of it is that opening up means different things in different states. But I do think, I mean, all the evidence suggests that it is linked to opening up. I just don't know if we have definitive proof of that.
And you mentioned testing, because you do hear the argument from some quarters that now there's more testing available. This may account for the higher number of infections that are recorded.
So I think testing is a small part of the increase. I don't think it's the whole story. I actually think that while testing is better than what it was, it's still far from where it needs to be. And obviously, testing is not going to explain the increases in hospitalizations that we're seeing. Those are really just from the infections and people getting sick from the infections.
So we hear what you're saying about you're worried and you don't see what is going to slow this down going forward. At the same time, you have this passionate argument on the part of people like Governor Ivey of Alabama, who has said livelihoods matter too. We have to get people back to work, back earning income. How do you strike the right balance?
Yeah, so I am very sympathetic to that argument that livelihoods matter. Of course they do. We know there's a huge health and psychological cost of the economic shutdown. The point here is as cases go up and as cases rage across Alabama and across other states, I think that's going to have a direct negative economic impact on that state. I think it's going to be hard for the economy to fully open up. What I have always argued for is that we needed to bring the virus levels down. We need to build in a testing infrastructure and then open up more safely so that we could have an economy and save lives. We're sort of managing to do neither.
And so do you see a way to signal to the leaders in these states who seem to have made up their minds that they're going forward to put the brakes on this to some extent?
Yeah, so what I've been saying to states is if you're starting to see these kinds of increases, you have to put in some amount of social distancing. I understand you may not want to do a full lockdown, but you've got to really think about what you can roll back. You've got to ramp up testing and tracing. You've got to do everything you can to slow down the spread of this virus, because once it gets really out of control, then you'll have very few choices and you'll really be forced to shut down. And that would not be a great outcome for anybody.
Dr. Jha, I also want to ask you about asymptomatic transmission of COVID. As you know, World Health Organization put out a statement a day or so ago saying there was less evidence of transmission of infection by people without symptoms, but then they turned around and corrected that. What, tell us the accurate, what is accurately understood to be the case for people who don't have symptoms, but who do have COVID.
Yeah, based on all the evidence we have right now, there is no doubt in my mind that people without symptoms do transmit the disease. They can, and they're actually probably a pretty major source of infections. So I think that was a misstatement by WHO. It was very unfortunate. They have walked it back. Asymptomatic spread is a real part of what makes controlling this disease so hard.
And finally, Dr. Zhao, I want to ask you about this because this is questions being raised in a number of quarters. Your institute, other places, forecast a much higher need for beds than has turned out to be the case in a number of states, and a higher infection rate, we've heard, predicted. Was there too grim a scenario that was forecast, do you think, by many in the public health community?
You know, what we did was we looked at the best data we had at that time from China and from Italy, and we saw the spread in the U.S. And I think everybody laid out what were potential scenarios. It's one of those situations where then I think we acted very aggressively. Certainly in March and April, much of the country was shut down, and we were able to curtail this. And so I don't know, I personally don't think we overreacted. I still feel like we did the right thing in shutting down the country. The newest evidence is that if we hadn't done that, we would have had 60 million more infections, probably 500,000 more deaths. So we prevented that. Did the policy, was it perfectly tuned to every single region of the country? It probably wasn't. But I think overall, the response so far on that front has been right. We just haven't done the other stuff we need, like the testing and tracing infrastructure that would allow us to open up safely again. We've talked about this before, Judy. That has been, continues to be, I think, an Achilles heel of this response in the country.
Dr. Ashish Jha, joining us once again. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Now to Syria and the brutal war in its 10th year amid depravity and renewed bombing by the air corps of Bashar al-Assad and his Russian backers. A new worry, coronavirus. As Nick Schifrin reports, people who have suffered so much now are preparing for a foe they can't see.
In a small office in northwest Syria, engineers prepare for another war against COVID. For weeks, they've feared a nightmare, an outbreak within a war zone. So they're making homemade COVID-19 tests.
There is only one testing machine in all of Idlib province for 4 million people. It's not enough. So we decided to start designing a machine that would allow for testing multiple samples for coronavirus in a short period of time.
To get to the workshop, Ayub Halak walks through a homemade disinfecting machine. And they're also making ventilators out of wooden boards and plastic tubing. They hope to make hundreds for local hospitals.
We decided to create a ventilator with what was available. There is a big shortage of ventilators in hospitals here.
In a nearby textile factory, workers make masks that'll cost about $4 a box, a discount compared to the $12 set imported from China.
There's been a huge increase in the demand for masks here because of the virus threat. We imported all of the raw material from Turkey, and we're stitching everything here by hand.
After 10 years of war, Syria is ill-prepared for another catastrophe. Syria's healthcare system is destroyed. The UN says Russia and the regime have targeted more than 80 medical facilities since December. Half of all hospitals are out of service. And that was before COVID. Dr. Ahmed Satou fears coronavirus's arrival is just a matter of time.
It would be a disaster. We don't have enough masks. We don't have enough hand sanitizer or even a properly functioning sewage system. We can't imagine how bad it could be, how many people could be infected if coronavirus reached us.
Last year, the Syrian regime and Russian military launched a major campaign to recapture Idlib. In January, they declared a ceasefire and the bombing slowed. But this week, Syrian and Russian planes launched airstrikes designed to retake the opposition's final stronghold. Idlib has been the last point of refuge for millions of Syrians internally displaced. And in cramped camps, social distancing is impossible. And the pandemic puts basic needs even more out of reach. Food prices are spiraling. Nearly 10 million people are now food insecure. And residents struggle to find enough water. Shortages make hand washing a luxury. As for power, in some places, generators are the only source. And these Syrians, who have lost their homes and all their rights, connect to a cause sparked 6,000 miles away. Artist Aziz Alsmar says his canvases go where lives have been extinguished. He created a George Floyd memorial on all that's left of a blown-out building.
There used to be people here with memories, families living here with children. The killing of George Floyd makes us think of the killing of young people from the Syrian regime's chemical gas. We are with Black Americans and feel their pain.
But as is the case for so many in Syria, a gesture of humanity from those who've experienced inhumanity has now been defaced. 300 miles away, in Kurdish-controlled northeast Syria, more than 100,000 people live in the Al-Hol camp. Healthcare workers do their best to sanitize this medical tent and teach proper hand washing. There's not enough testing to know whether COVID cases are low. But here in the northeast, at least the Kurdish Red Crescent can create a medical facility without fear of attack. For now, Syrian civilians are doing what they can to prevent another nightmare. Fatima is 8.
Wash your hands thoroughly with soap and water. And when you sneeze or cough, you do this.
Fatima is younger than the war, but now has to prepare for another battle. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
Nearly one in four Americans live with a disability, and for some, that means having a compromised immune system and a higher likelihood of getting the coronavirus. Advocates are now sounding the alarm that Congress needs to do more to help society's most vulnerable. I spoke about this with former Pennsylvania governor and former Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge. He's now the chairman of the National Organization on Disability. And Danny Woodburn, an actor and a disability rights activist. We began our conversation by discussing how those with disabilities are affected in this pandemic.
First of all, I think there's a fear around going in. Obviously, this community is more at risk, but also there's the notion that decisions might be being made with regard to the quality of life and whether or not a person's quality of life is worth saving. So, and we talk about advocacy, for example, having an advocate in the room for people with disabilities, especially somebody with, say, Down syndrome, who has to go in and can't have a family member there or a person who's been taking care of them, working with them over the years to help them make decisions about their medical care. So this puts them more at risk. And there's policy being looked at now that is a bit scary to people with disabilities, that determinations are being made, like who gets a ventilator based on, physical and cognitive ability, how the virus might have been affecting them, and whether or not they get to keep a ventilator.
Governor Tom Ridge is somebody who's been involved with the disability community for a long time. Are these issues that have been discussed in the past, or is this something that is just now for the first time being thought about seriously?
One of the challenges that Danny and I and the broader disability community organizations are dealing with is that we've made modest changes and very important and positive changes since the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act 30 years ago. This is the 30th anniversary year of ADA. But what has happened during the COVID crisis, during this pandemic, is we're seeing that for the first time in 30 years, we don't have a seat at the table There have been several rescue packages coming from Washington, D.C. And appropriately, they're trying to reach out to those who are most affected by it and trying to reach out in economic terms and trying to help people through this very difficult period. We've had 15 or 16 disability organizations write to Congress, write to the leadership, and say, you know, we need some more support for home and community-based health care. We do not want to be discriminated against as a population, and people with disabilities have lost a much higher percentage of their jobs. We haven't really been at any advantage or any focus put on us by the public policymakers. When you talk about vulnerability, you talk about poverty, you talk about minorities, but we're never, the disability community is never mentioned. And we think it's time to focus on that because we don't want to roll back the gains we've made over the past 30 years as a result of the COVID crisis.
Danny Woodburn, as we listen to the two of you, is it truly the case that the disability community is just not heard at a time like this?
Well, I think within our community, one of the issues that we struggle with is coming together with a unified message. You know, there are so many vast types of disability and so many advocacy groups that people are releasing their own agenda with regard to what needs to be looked at. So it would be great if our community could get together into a unified message and have these different, branches of our community speak to each other. But that sort of thing takes a lot of organization.
Governor Ridge, let's pick up on that the community has not been unified in making some of these arguments and coming forward in the past. Is that truly an obstacle here?
You raise a very important aspect and condition of the community of the disabled. About 2 years ago, the National Organization on Disability, which is basically agnostic with regard to the disability, could be autism, could be blindness, could be Down syndrome. I mean, there's a range of disabilities. We basically say, as part of our advocacy platform, we're for all of you. And we want the broader employment community to understand that people with disabilities are often the last hired and then the first to let go. So we're trying to speak with one voice. And the first thing we would like to do is have the policymakers reach out to the organization to say, what are the basic components of agreement? In spite of the disability advocacy groups, there are certain things across the board we all agree upon, and that is the need for attendant care, home and community-based services, and more employment options. But I think if nothing else, the pandemic has demonstrated that people with disabilities can add value to your organization if you give them the opportunity to work at home. They have a quality of life. They want to work. They want to live like everybody else. And their notion of self-worth is based on what they can do for themselves. So hopefully, when we get through this, people will understand and organizations will understand hiring people with disabilities should be a priority.
And just finally, to both of you, a message to those in the disability community who are watching this, listening to this, in terms of why they should have hope for the future. Danny Woodburn.
Well, there are a lot of people. I have a lot of friends in this advocacy world when it comes to disability. I know a number of journalists that write and expound on the treatment of people with disabilities. And just in my industry alone, watching the change over the last 4 years, the change in employment with regard to people with disabilities that I've been very much a part of in terms of helping to make those changes. Seeing that is important, and remembering that path upward existed for the last several years. We want to make sure that we each continue to have a voice so that path, even after this pandemic is over and done with, that we continue on that upswing, and then to keep talking as much as possible about these issues.
Governor Ridge, a message of hope?
There certainly should be a message of hope. Ironically, Americans without disabilities have been living, in many cases, in isolation without a great deal of contact with the rest of the world. For a large number of men and women and children with disabilities, that's how they live, and it's impacted the quality of their life. And they have the same aspirations as those without disabilities. And so one of the ironies of this this isolation is, I'd like to think there's greater empathy and understanding of how people with disabilities live and work and deal with their personal and family situations. And hopefully during this crisis, there's a greater appreciation in the broader community, how valuable they are and how important they are to be integrated and become much more a part of our broader community.
Such an important set of issues. I want to thank you both, Governor Tom Ridge, Danny Woodburn. We appreciate it.
We appreciate you. Thank you.
And finally tonight, in the midst of these turbulent times, and as more people start to venture out, gardening is providing a bit of sanity and fresh air. Jeffrey Brown talked recently with a man known for the gardens he's created around the world, including at New York's hugely popular and influential Highline Park. The story is part of our ongoing arts and culture series, Canvas.
Artis Iberica. See, if we go into the garden, we see the Ferroni Custom coming up.
For everyone who's been locked down, spending too much time indoors, a visit to the garden.
Yeah, I'm Sonia Tabernet Montana. Euphorium, Natrum. Hello, Duffy.
And not just any garden, but the personal creation of Pete Odolph, one of the world's most renowned landscape designers.
They're not afraid.
Also, this being springtime, the birds and bees are busy.
I'm outside, you're outside, but
we're not together this time. Too bad.
Yeah, it is. There's so much happening at the moment, you know, so many things coming to flower.
Okay, I recognize this. Great.
This was actually a virtual revisit.
You recognize the tunnel where we were in?
This is the original.
Last year, this we had an old-fashioned personal tour of the farm in the rural town of Hummelo, in the eastern part of the Netherlands near the German border. It was winter then, but for Odolph, the garden is ever alive, a place of emotion. Changing shape, texture, color. Different, but wondrous in every season. As he told me now from the studio where he draws his designs.
Talking about seasons, the moment you understand gardening and you are a gardener, then you then every day is special. I think every day is an experience because there's always something that you will like, and it's not only about the plants, it's also about the light and the movement.
The world has looked strange these past months. Familiar places no longer familiar at all. Last year, we'd visited Amsterdam's world-famous Rijksmuseum, normally a busy crossroads. Now, a few bikes forced to keep their distance. One of the park-like spaces Pete Odolph designed, Chicago's Lurie Garden, remains closed. The plants still need tending, the spring bulbs prepared for next year's bloom.
Hey, these are all the babies.
Many people have turned to their own or community gardens during this period, growing vegetables and flowers, nourishing body and soul. Gardening centers have been among the first essential businesses to reopen. Sales of seeds have soared. Pete Odolph isn't surprised.
Once you are touched to plants and just start to work with them, it's a big chance that you get lost in the world of plants and that you want to experience more of gardening. You can think while you're gardening, and you can think about life and how to follow up after this crisis.
Since we spoke to Odolph, the world has changed yet again, with mass demonstrations in the wake of the killing of George Floyd bringing thousands of people into the streets. But it remains unclear what kind of impact the pandemic will have on the design and use of urban spaces and on the public's willingness to be in close proximity.
You see, there's so many people, and if you look at how much distance they should have, so we still don't know what to do, but at least people want to go to places where I normally would go to, you know, to gardens and to parks. And I think that people will realize that we as human beings need that to feel good.
Odolph can't travel now, but he's still working on designs for gardens around the world. I asked what advice he has for amateur gardeners.
It's pleasure and entertainment at the same time.
in the garden is a sort of performance. So it is beautiful, but also beautiful to do it on your own way.
Performance, that's an interesting way of thinking about it, huh?
I think it is a performance or not. They show up and they go away. They leave the stage after a few months, especially plants. If you look at these flowers, Amsonia, in 3 weeks' time, there's no flower anymore. Then the seeds come. So it's also that the changes of character of a plant is important for how you make a garden. But what I say for people that just start gardening, I think anything that you see in a garden center that you like can be a good start of to become a serious gardener.
For the PBS NewsHour, and with the hope of being once again in the garden with Pete Outolf, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
What a beautiful place. So wonderful to see that. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.